The lectures for Deuteronomy chapters 1 through 5 were given by Carol Webster, and apparently the tapes did not take, so I am going to read from the Shepherd's Notes these verses in order to keep continuity with the lecture. Deuteronomy is a forward-looking book. Each of Moses' sermons anticipated the day when Israel will be settled in the Promised Land. His words saw the potential for a great future which lay open like an unread scroll before Israel. Yet Moses began Deuteronomy by speaking about the past, by highlighting certain events from the recent history of ancient Israel, many of which were vividly recalled by Moses' audience. He was able to illustrate graphically just what the covenant relationship that God had established with his people would involve. Moses spoke to Israel east of the Jordan River on the plains of Moab, 40 years after the exodus from Egypt and subsequent to Israel's defeat of Sihon and Og, two powerful kings who lived in the Transjordan. Most of the places named listed in verse 1 cannot be identified. They're probably stopping places on the way from Horeb to Moab. The first day of the 11th month occurred about in the middle of our January. These are the words Moses spoke to all Israel, verse 1. Moses proclaimed to the Israelites all the Lord had commanded him concerning them, verse 3. Moses began to expound this law, saying, verse 5. With these words, Deuteronomy established a clear and deliberate line of authority which passed from God to Moses to Israel. Moses would speak God's words directly to Israel and interpret them in a way wholly consistent with the previous revelation which he had received at Mount Sinai. In this way, the validity of Moses' words were grounded not in himself or even in the covenant-making revelation of Sinai, but in the reality of God. The journey from Moab, Sinai, to the plains of Moab is Deuteronomy 1, verses 6, through chapter 3, verse 29. Moses' first sermon reviewed events from the past 40 years of Israel's history. He spoke first of instances of disobedience and judgment, but then reminded Israel of times when they had been obedient and God had blessed. This portion of Deuteronomy forms the historical prologue section of a vassal treaty format which provides the basic structure of the book. The wanderings are recorded in chapter 1. Moses' sermon opened with a warning. Disobedience had led an entire generation of Israel, as it would Moses, to die outside the Promised Land. Verses 6 to 8 deal with the departure. The history of Israel recorded in Deuteronomy began not with the exodus from Egypt, but with a departure from Mount Sinai, here called Horeb. That is, it began with a covenant which God has established with Moses and the people of Israel already in place. While the Israelites were still in Horeb, God told Israel that it was time for them to take hold of the land which he had promised to give to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob. An immediate conquest of the land of Canaan could have happened. Israel had their chance at entering the land of their inheritance, but unbelief and then disobedience caused God to postpone the fulfillment of his promise. Moses' audience, standing on the plains of Moab and getting ready to try to enter the land of promise again, knew all this too well. Next, we see the appointment of leaders for Israel. Because Moses was not able to bear personally all of the numerous problems, burdens, and disputes which accompanied so great a multitude, he appointed a judiciary to operate under him. The men of the judiciary, chosen for their wisdom, understanding, and experience, were commanded to judge righteously and without partiality, for such judgment belongs to God. By reminding Israel of the distribution of authority among their elders at the beginning of his first sermon, Moses sought to make three things clear from the very beginning. First, the need to appoint additional leaders was a good thing that had arisen only because God had fulfilled his promise to make them a mighty nation. Secondly, as a covenant community, Israel had to share certain responsibilities. The cooperation of everyone for the common good was necessary to benefit all. And third, in spite of the appointment of effective leaders, the people of Israel still rebelled against God. The problem lay not with the system of leadership, but with each individual heart. Next, we see the spies and Israel's unbelief. 11 days out of Horeb, Israel arrived at Kadesh Barnea, a large oasis in the northeastern Sinai Peninsula. From there, Moses sent spies into Canaan, the land of the Amorites, to scout out the land for Israel's anticipated occupation. The spies brought back a good report, but the people did not believe the land could be taken, and so rebelled against both Moses and God. As a result, God condemned Israel to wander about through all the vast and dreadful desert until everyone who was of the age of accountability, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb, who had believed, died. Israel refused to accept their punishment and tried to invade Canaan anyway, but were defeated in battle. Moses' account of Israel's rebellion at Kadesh Barnea in Deuteronomy chapter 1 added an emphasis not found in the story as it was first given in Numbers 13 and 14. In Deuteronomy, Moses was careful to emphasize the goodness of God in providing for Israel, comparing God's care to that of a father for his own son. It was the sons and daughters of the unbelieving Israelites, children who do not yet know good from bad, who would next have a chance to enter their promised land. These children were now wandering, toughened adults, standing now ready and eager to succeed where their parents had failed. The conquest and settlement of Transjordan is recorded in 2 and 3. After wandering in the wilderness for almost 40 years, God offered Israel a new chance to enter the land of Canaan. This time, the promise made to Abraham 4 centuries earlier was set to be fulfilled. Moses quickly passed over the generation-long periods of wilderness wanderings to emphasize Israel's advance through southern Transjordan to the plains of Moab. God told Moses to lead Israel through Sur, or Edom, and Moab. Israel had approached the border of Ammon, which was told not to contend with them either, for they too had been descendants from Lot, and as such had received an inheritance from God. It was important for later Israelites to know why the lands of Edom, Moab, and Ammon were never conquered or apportioned as an inheritance for the 12 tribes. These lands remained eastern enemies throughout the time of the Old Testament. Moses made a special chronological note in connection with the crossing of the Israelites into Moab, the journey from Kadesh Barnea to the rugged Zered River Valley, the southern border of Moab, took 38 years. During this time, the entire generation of fighting men who had not believed the spies' report died. By making this note, Moses confirmed that God's spoken judgments were sure and hinted that when Canaan was conquered, it would be by the strength of God, not by military strength. 2:24 through 3:11 then records the victories over Sihon, the king of Hesbon, and Og, the king of Bashan. The Amorite king Sihon had established a kingdom based at Hesbon, a city on a plateau between Moab and Ammon, just east of Israel's intended destination on the plains of Moab. God told Moses to begin the conquest of Israel's promised land by taking the kingdom of Sihon. Sihon provoked war when he, with a hardened heart, refused Israel's passage through his land. Israel defeated Sihon by the power of God and captured all his land from the Arnon River that empties into the Dead Sea to the Jabbok River that flows into the Jordan, 50 miles to the north. Moses then defeated Og, the king of Bashan, who controlled the high and fertile region lying east of the Sea of Galilee and stretching from the Jabbok River north to Mount Hermon. Bashan was a kingdom of strong cities, and its king a man of renown, whose huge iron bed became a museum piece even in antiquity. Yet he, like Sihon, was defeated by the power of God. The description of the defeat of Sihon and Og is graphic and, for modern sensibilities, rather shocking. According to Moses, "We took all his towns and completely destroyed them. Men, women, and children, we left no survivors. All this was done at the command of God." Why would God command such an act when a simple defeat of the trained armies of Sihon and Og would have given Moses the land? These battles and several others which Israel would fight once in the land of Canaan are referred to as holy wars. A holy war was a battle commanded by God to completely destroy a people already living in the promised land who belonged to another god. Such people stood to undermine God's purpose for Israel. A holy war was primarily a religious act and had to follow certain guidelines. The practice of holy war was limited to a short period of Israel's history and in no way serves as a paradigm for Christian behavior today, except to underline the exclusive holiness demanded by God and to recognize that ultimately He is the victor over all sin. I want to add my own comments in here too, because God only declared holy war on seven nations, and each of these seven nations was given 430 years, of which they knew everything God was doing with Israel, was aware of the covenant and what God required, and given an opportunity to turn to the true and living God, but refused. So this holy war did not come out of nothing. It came after a long time of God's patience and realizing that they were not going to turn to God. Well, continuing on with a commentary then, we come to the tribal inheritance in Transjordan, chapter 3, verses 12 through 22. After defeating the kingdoms of Shion and Og, God instructed Moses to apportion their land to 2 1/2 of the Israelite tribes. The tribes of Reuben and Gad received the land which had been taken from Shion. This land was particularly well suited to cattle grazing, which formed the economic basis of these tribes. Jer and Mekur, two clans from the tribe of Manasseh, that's where we get the half-tribe from, received the land which belonged to Og. After apportioning their land, Moses made sure that Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh knew their responsibility to aid the other Israelite tribes in conquering the land west of the Jordan. Moses reassured Joshua that God would fight for him once Israel crossed into Canaan. Well, with the conquest now of the lands in Transjordan and their apportionment to various Israelite tribes, the promise of land which God had made to Abraham 4 centuries early began to be fulfilled. But Moses is denied entrance into the promised land. Chapter 3, 23 through 29. Moses, who had lived long and witnessed many mighty acts of God, was awestruck at the great things that yet lay in store for Israel. O sovereign Lord, he said, you have only begun to show your servant your great and your strong hand. Moses begged God to allow him to at least see the promised land, but God refused. Moses could only view the land from afar. God would charge Joshua to lead Israel into Canaan. Moses did not specify the reason why God would not allow him to enter Canaan other than to say, it was because of you that the Lord was angry with me. Later in the book, Moses reported that God told him that Moses had broken faith in not upholding his holiness before Israel. This Moses had done by co-opting God's power when he faced a rebellious Israel in the wilderness of Zin, recorded in Numbers 20. In the end, Moses too forfeited the land of promise. Moses, not to be an exception because of his high position of leadership, faced the consequences of his action, just as all people do. Yet God was gracious and allowed him at least to see the land for which he longed for. Moses' call to obedience is in Deuteronomy 4. Moses issued a passionate call to obey God following his recitation of key events which led Israel to the point of entering the promised land. This call was based on past actions, on the choices which faced Israel in the future, and on the character of God. A call to obey was based on the past. Moses' call on Israel to heed and obey God so they might live and enter the land of promise. He first illustrated the need to obey by offering warnings from the past. He carefully interspersed his call for obedience with stated or implied examples of Israel's former unbelief, the sexual idolatry at Baal Peor, the golden calf at Mount Sinai, and the rebellion in the wilderness of Zin, which had tripped up even him. Moses gave a second reason to help God's statutes. Doing so would show your wisdom and understanding to the nations. Israel's wisdom, their skill in living, came from divine revelation, not human reasoning. By remembering the awesome appearance of God at Mount Sinai, Israel would learn how to fear Him. By obeying the instructions in the 5 books of Moses called the Torah, which God revealed at Mount Sinai, Israel would learn how to live. The nations round about would see and respond favorably to Israel, for God had long ago promised that they would be a blessing by the descendants of Abraham. Moses called Israel to live in obedience to God so they could live in the promised land and draw other nations to Him. This was the essence of the promise which God had made to Abraham. A call to obey is based on the future in chapter 4, 25 through 31. Having surveyed the past, Moses now looked to the future. The past generation had not believed God. Would future generations, the children and grandchildren of Moses' audience, do any better? Moses warned that should Israel continue to choose not to believe or obey, they would be driven out of the Promised Land and would live among the idolatrous nations. Moses, if you sin, in verse 25, could well have been when you sin. In Genesis, Moses had written of how Adam and Eve and Cain were exiled from their special lands. He now anticipated the future exile of Israel to Assyria and Judah to Babylon. But God is gracious. If Israel would sincerely return to him, he would certainly forgive and restore them. The pattern of rebellion, retribution, repentance, restoration becomes common during the period recorded in the book of Judges. The clearest call, however, was made by the writer of Chronicles. If my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sins and heal their land. 2 Chronicles 7:14. Moses had great expectations for Israel's future, but he knew that God's blessings were conditional, based on Israel's obedience and belief. Nevertheless, God was gracious and would not forget his covenant. The call to obey based on the uniqueness of God is recorded in chapter 4, verses 32 through 40. Moses ends his first sermon by calling on Israel to obey simply because of who God is. Through a series of rhetorical questions, Moses leads Israel to realize that God is totally and absolutely unique. No other God speaks audibly without man-made form. No other God redeemed a miserable people from slavery and forged them into a great and feared nation. No other God cares enough for people to discipline and to love them. No other God, in fact, even exists. For this reason alone, Israel ought to respond with obedience. The call to obey is grounded ultimately in God's sovereign power and his love and concern for his people. The past and the future may be untouchable, but the possibility for a relationship with God is very much in the present. Next, he goes on to the cities of refuge in the Transjordan, recorded in 4:41 through 43. Moses lists the three cities of refuge in the Transjordan as an appendix to his first sermon. This was an appropriate place for the list because his first sermon focused on the conquest and settlement of the Transjordan by Israel. Joshua would designate three more cities of refuge in the land of Canaan, according to the instructions given by Moses, thereby bringing the total to six. By providing cities of refuge, God showed himself to be both generous and just. But instilling these same qualities in his people, God sought to establish a righteous society. Moses' second sermon begins in 4:44 and goes to the end of chapter 26. It's called Getting Ready for the Present. Moses' second sermon is the longest in the book of Deuteronomy. In it, he sought to prepare Israel for life in the Promised Land, soon to be a very present reality. This Moses did by explaining how the Ten Commandments, which God had given at Mount Sinai, were to be relevant for Israel's new landed life in Canaan. Moses first restated the Ten Commandments, then provided general principles and specific stipulations which issued from them. The context of this sermon corresponds to the main section of an ancient vassal treaty form in which the book of Deuteronomy was based. This section of the vassal treaties carefully stipulated the principles and guidelines which define the relationship between the treaty parties, God and Israel in this case. The superior party, God, expects the lesser party, Israel, to obey. In return, Israel would be cared for by God. The heart of the covenant is recorded in chapter 4:44 through 5:33. The Ten Commandments form the heart of God's covenant. In compressed form, they contained everything that God demands of his people. In addition, they are a window to the character of God. By incorporating the Ten Commandments into the Sermon on Mount, Jesus upheld their validity for Christians today. The covenant setting. Moses introduced the covenant by summarizing its contents, its origin, and the locale in which it was delivered to Israel. Moses described the content of the covenant as laws, literally Torahs, or instructions. Specifically, this instruction contained statutes, decrees, and ordinances, or things commanded by God. As divine sovereign, God holds the right to command obedience. His people, on the other hand, learn how to live by listening to him and obeying what he commands. This instruction came from Moses, who had received it directly from God. It was delivered to Israel on the plains of Moab, here called the valley near Beth Peor. Across the Jordan River from the Jericho, after Israel had conquered the lands in Transjordan belonging to Shion and Og. By explaining the Ten Commandments to Israel, Moses prepared them for life in the Promised Land. Moses spoke to the point, the covenant which God made at Mount Sinai was for the present, for us, all of us who are alive here today. Its immediacy is evident. The form of the Ten Commandments as spoken by Moses in Deuteronomy is virtually identical to that in Exodus 20, except that the reason given for keeping the Sabbath in Deuteronomy was to remember Israel's redemption from Egypt rather than the 7 days of creation. The commandments may be divided into two sections. The first four speak of Israel's relationship to God. Their overall theme is the worth and worship of God alone. The last six treat interpersonal relationships. They establish the principle that all people are of inestimable value and as such have rights which must be protected. Throughout the remainder of his sermon, Moses explains that each of the Ten Commandments meant to Israel. Because the first two commandments form the basis from the rest, they receive extensive treatment in chapters 6 through 12 of Deuteronomy. Matters relating to the rest follow in chapters 13 through 25. The Ten Commandments, the very words of God, provide all of the necessary principles by which God's people may live lives pleasing to Him. As Moses made the commandments relevant for ancient Israel, so Jesus did for the New Testament time. Upon hearing the voice of God booming from Mount Sinai, a mountain enveloped in fire and thick darkness, the Israelites were overcome with fear. They begged Moses to approach the mountain in their place, lest they be consumed by fire of God, then agreed in desperation to hear and obey everything God commanded them to do. God's response was passionate. Oh, that their hearts would be inclined to fear me and keep all my words, always. The type of fear that the Israelites experienced was not the type of reverence which God expected of them. Moses then received from God the specific decrees, statutes, and ordinances by which he was to teach Israel how to live after they had arrived in the Promised Land. These laws form the bulk of the book of Deuteronomy. Israel recognized that a great gulf lay between themselves and God. There was a dire need for an intermediary to build a bridge that gapped that. That intermediary, in this case, was Moses, who willingly mediated God's covenant to Israel. In doing so, he foreshadowed Jesus Christ, who freely mediated God's new covenant to all believers.